I'm here to everybody. Welcome back after, I guess, a few week hiatus. Hope everybody had a wonderful, wonderful Pesach. I just want to make mention before we start, of course, that this evening is Yom HaShoah. I know you're doing letters of the Rav. I don't know if he has any letters about Yom HaShoah. Interesting, where Soloveitchik was not a fan of Yom HaShoah. He felt that everything should be on Tisha B'Av, but that's not the discussion here. Fascinating. All I'll say is I recommend J.J. Schechter's article if you want to read about it. But of course, the Jewish people, I guess in many ways, it's the saddest day of the year, I would say, in some ways. Even, I know we don't observe it that way, but you think about it, the destruction of European Jewry, the murder of 6 million Jews was way worse than the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. I don't think there's any comparison, and I just think we should keep that in mind. And then the Shema should have Aliyot, and we should have good things to celebrate. And I don't come from a family of survivors. I imagine many other people here do. But anyways, I just did want to make mention of that, and we should keep that in mind. Okay, Dr. Mark, it's all yours.
Okay, good. Glad to be here. We were supposed to be here 2 weeks ago, but we realized Monday that everyone is traveling or busy, so we didn't think we'd have a nice crowd. So we canceled that, but now we're back, and I'm glad to be so, and also very happy in Florida to have met people who are listening to the classes. Maybe some of you are with us right now. Someone who wasn't listening, but his father is listening, from Potomac, Maryland. So you know who you are, and thank you for telling your son. Okay, as always, let me start with some interesting things, just no order in particular, but we got today maybe will be the last of the letters, if not definitely the time after that. And then we'll get to the letters that weren't published. And then I want to circle back to look at Rabbi Helfgott's book. By the way, there's a, I think most realize that during Pesach, Chol HaMoed, it was the 30th Yahrzeit of Rav Soloveitchik. So there's a lot going on, a lot of discussions. This came in the mail today for me. Well, I just got home. I don't know when it came. It was maybe during Pesach, Tradition Spring 2023, devoted to Rabbi Soloveitchik. I haven't had a chance to look at it. I see Tova Lichtenstein has a biographical sketch of her mother. Lots of interesting things. I'll try to report next week if I can. Just I did look at Rabbi Helfgott's piece, and he has Rav Soloveitchik on religious Zionism in the State of Israel. We're going to see some of that today. And he says, another group of letters has recently been brought to light by Professor Mark B. Shapiro and were published in the original Hebrew in Hakira 32. My thanks to him for permission to translate and publish letters 2 to 8 and 12. So 2 to 8, that's 7 letters, and then another one, 12. So a significant portion of Rabbi Helfgott's letter. He has here 15 letters, so half of them are translations from the letters I published. I wonder now if anyone's going to refer to my publication, because people like the translations. So maybe people will forget about what I did. Although you'll see today that one of the letters he translates, he leaves out something which I think is worthwhile. So let me put this aside. We'll get to that. Understandably, in the Mizrahi magazine, the Rav, giant of religious Zionism, commemorating Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's 30th Yahrzeit, exclusive book launch, Drushos of the Rav on Zionism, will be available in English. So that volume I showed you from Rav Soloveitchik, the Yiddish talks he gave on religious Zionism, it's coming out in English. It's not yet on Amazon. I don't even know if it appeared yet, but it'll appear soon. I have to say, however, that there are some mistakes in this issue. Let me just call your attention to them. In Rabbi Ganak's article, Rav Soloveitchik and Religious Zionism, page 12, he talks about what we mentioned, how the Rav was an Agudist, on the Moetzes Chachmei Torah of the Aguda in America. Actually, I'll show you the page. They didn't call it Chachmei Torah. They would call it Gedolei Torah. But then he said that the Rav paid a price for his membership in the Aguda. He says that he was one of three candidates for the chief rabbi in Tel Aviv. The other two were of Herzog or of Amiel. During the elections for this position, Rav Kook passed away, and Rav Herzog was chosen to be Rav Kook's successor as chief rabbi of Palestine. Of the remaining candidates, Rav Amiel was elected chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Well, that's not true. Rav Herzog was not elected chief rabbi during this period. Rav Herzog never withdrew. The election to chief rabbi of Tel Aviv was among three. Rav Amiel, who I think got 22 votes, Rav Herzog, who got 10 votes, and Rav Soloveitchik, who got 9 votes. Rav Herzog, only after losing for the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, was he then once again brought back into the ring, and there was a second election. And that was between him and Rav Charlap. And Rav Herzog won that. So I don't know why he said that. That's just wrong. The next thing he said that's wrong, it's wrong, but he didn't, the fault is not his. He says that his uncle, Rav Eliyahu Moshe Genachovsky, a member of the first Knesset, told me that Meir Bar-Ilan, who was the Rav's great-great-uncle, gave his support to Rav Amiel's candidacy because the Rav was associated with the Aguda. That point is repeated in a variety of other places, but it too is not correct. And you can see it in Aviad HaKohen's new long article on the Rav's candidacy for chief rabbinate and why he didn't go to the State of Israel. Rav Meir Bar-Ilan supported the Rav. He even gave a talk in support of the Rav, which as a family member we'd expect perhaps. I also have to say that in 1935, I don't believe you can say, as Rabbi Ganach says, that the Rav was affiliated with the Aguda. What makes the Rav affiliated with the Aguda in 1935? We're all accustomed to say that Rav Soloveitchik was an Agudist, and he was. I'll show you the proof of this in a few minutes, and that everything changed because of the Holocaust. And then the Rav himself, in one of his talks, says that. However, we have a very interesting article that appears a few years ago. I'll show it to you.
Let me get it.
Seth Farber. This is from 2020, and it's called Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Early Zionism. And in this article, he takes up this notion, which I also expressed, that it was the Holocaust. As he says, this is the contemporary view, basically, is that prior to the Holocaust, the Rav was a member of the Aguda, and thus ambivalent to Zionism, only later did he embrace the Mizrahi movement. What Farber shows here is that even before the Holocaust, and he shows this by a speech that the Rav gave in 1939, a Yiddish speech from one of the Boston Yiddish papers, in which the Rav calls for aiding Mizrahi. So you see that the Rav was... I think it would be more fair, based on this article, to say that the Rav, even if he associated with the Aguda, he also saw a lot of value in Mizrahi. And maybe he didn't really associate with the Aguda. Maybe they asked him to be on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, so he was on it. But that doesn't mean he wouldn't have been on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah Mizrahi if they also asked. So I recommend everyone to take a look at this article. He cites what the Rav said, where the Rav says the years of Hitler's Holocaust, the rise of the state and the accomplishment of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me of the just path of our movement. So he says that the Rav doesn't say here that the Holocaust caused me to change my view. Rather, it convinced me of the justice of the path of Mizrahi, with the implication, perhaps, that he had already made this decision prior. And then he also says that here he's being a darshan. So he says he was accentuating and personalizing the devastation of the Holocaust and the positive value of Zionism. So in other words, he says, quote, this was not meant to be a definitive autobiographical statement. He thinks that the Rav used his liberty as a darshan there to not be exact in when he became a Mizrahi. I mean, as a darshan, there's significance in saying that, you know, the Holocaust showed me that our movement was correct, even though he also saw value in the movement before the Holocaust. That's what Seth Farber puts out. And he says that the biographers do not say this. So this is a revisionist article. Thank you, Rabbi Farber. If you look, well, what do I mean by that the Rav though is in Hapardes? If you look in 1940 and 1941, here's from 1940, September 1940, Hapardes. There's a whole report on the Aguda Convention in America. And who's Yoshev Rosh? The Vad HaPoel. What's the Vad HaPoel? That's what they call it in Aguda. I don't know how you translate it to English. The committee or executive committee, whatever you call it. So who is the head of it? Rabbi Yeshua Baumol. That's Rabbi Lamb's grandfather, incidentally. The next, who's the Sagan? Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Menachem Mendel Yeschadrov. And who's Yoshev Rosh Levad HaPoel HaMerkazi B'Medina? So you have Vad HaPoel HaKali and Vad HaPoel HaMerkazi. I don't exactly know the difference. It's Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. Furthermore, in this very issue, a couple, actually Rabbi, he was right, Rabbi Ganak. They called it here Moetzes Chachmei Torah, not Moetzes Gedolei Torah. But look who, this is from 1940, also September. Look who the Vod Moetzes Gedolei Torah is in America. Rabbi Elazar Silver, Ramosha Soloveitchik. Ramosha Soloveitchik, he wasn't such a fan of Aguda in Europe. In fact, he publicly came out against this whole idea of a Moetzes Gedolei Torah that they could make political statements. And he spoke for Mizrahi when he was in Europe. But it seems that he wasn't committed one way or the other way so strongly. And it could be that he thought that Aguda in America was not going to be like Aguda in Europe. Rav Eliezer Silver was very positively inclined to Mizrahi, even though he was a member of Aguda. So it's a different Aguda, I guess you could say, in America. Who else? Rav Chaim Yitzhak Korb. He was in Chicago. I don't know at this time, but later. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So here you see Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah of the Aguda. Rav Shlomo Hyman from Torah Vadas, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Natalovitz, Rabbi Mordechai, the Admor Beyond, Rabbi Mordechai Shlomo Friedman. That's 1940. Here's 1941. Rav Moshe Feinstein has already passed away. Nesar Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. But now look who's on the Moetzes Chachmei Torah. The Nesius is Rav Aaron Cutler, who has now come to America, Rav Eliezer Silver, and Rav Shlomo Hyman. Who else is on the Vod? Rav Rogozovsky, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Menachem Mendel Zaks, is the Bochen later at Yeshivas Rav Zalchanan, son-in-law of the Chavetz Chaim, Rav Avram Yafin, the Navardik Rosh Yeshiva. These are people who had come to Europe. They weren't here in 1940. They were here in 41. The Biana Rebbe again, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Bloch from Tel. So you see that the Rav was on the Moetzes Chachmei Torah of Aguda, but as Rabbi Farber shows, this didn't stop him from also expressing positive views of the Aguda. But this is in the 40s already. Is there any evidence that the Rav was associated with the Aguda in the 1930s? Before that, Rabbi Farber mentions, Rav Shlomo Pick has an article, I have it here somewhere, in which he mentions evidence that the Rav was positively inclined to Mizrahi. So he went back and forth. In fact, now I'm going to show you something. I'm going to give you a gift for all those who are writing on, want to write Rav Soloveitchik's biography. Here is something that I was planning on putting on the Sforim blog, have not put it on yet, and why should I withhold it? So here's the gift I'm going to give you. This, as far as I know, this is completely unknown. It's never been mentioned. We know basically nothing about the Rav's time in Berlin. But since we're talking about the Aguda, let me show you something. This is from the Israelit. This was the Orthodox newspaper in Germany of it was a Frankfurt paper, but it was all of Orthodox in Germany, but very closely tied to the Aguda. So in the February 7th, 1929 issue, there was an appendix of focusing only on Agudas Yisrael, the actions of Agudas Yisrael. Like you hear the schoolwork of Agudas Yisrael, the Eretz Yisrael work of Agudas Yisrael. And then you have at the bottom the let me enlarge this so you can see here, what's going on in Ezra. Ezra is the youth organization of Agudas Yisrael.
Oh, so here you have. In Germany, auf ein Gute, yes, later of Parley Gute. I'm sorry.
A Gute. And I want you all to look. I'm going to enlarge it right here. Here you see that it talks about there were shiurim given, multi-hour shiurim given in Gemara. And who gave one of the shiurim for the Aguda Youth Movement? Yosef Soloveitchik, on the theme of Nishma Rabatel et HaMitzvos. He's not called rabbi. He's 26 years old, but he's not called rabbi. So here you see with the Aguda. But don't think it means he's an Agudist, because on the very same page, and this is how I know about it, you have on the right side Rabbi Weinberg also speaking with the for the Ezra. And he was not an Agudist, but you can value Aguda and what they're doing without being an Agudist. So, and one other thing I see here that it says on page 14, they have an example of, they have some stuff from what the Rav said at Mizrahi conventions, and it says, beginning in the late 1930s and continuing for several decades, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik delivered the keynote address at the annual convention of the Mizrahi Organization of America. Okay, I know Mizrahi wants to grab the Rav for as long as they can, but in the late 1930s, the Rav was not delivering any keynote addresses at the Mizrahi organization. That would come later. He seems to have joined Mizrahi in 43, because already in January of 44, he's listed as being one of the leaders of Mizrahi. So, okay. Oh, I see it's already 8:47, and I have so many other things I want to give you. I'll save them for next week. Lots of good stuff. I'll just show you one thing, because Yisrael sent this to me, so let me share this with you. I can send the link to anyone. If anyone who's concerned about what's going on in Israel now with the so-called religious parties, you want to listen to this video. It's only 6 minutes where the Rav speaks, "My Problem with Israel." And what he says basically is that we've never been an oppressor. We've never oppressed others. We've never taken advantage of the weak. But the Rav says that's because we've always been the weak and we've always been the oppressed ones. What would happen if we became the powerful ones? And the Rav says, I don't think it's because we're better than everyone else. It's amazing he says that. But he says, I don't think it's because we're better than everyone else. We too can fall into the same traps. And look, the Rav knew his Tanakh. All you have to do is look at Sefer Malachim, and you can see the low levels that the people of Israel fell to. So the Rav says that this is the great test. We've never had the opportunity to be an oppressor. We've never had the opportunity to where our ethics are called, are tested to see how we're going to respond. He says, now we have that opportunity. And he says, I hope. He says, I'm not certain, but I hope we will rise to the task and we'll behave as the Torah wants us to behave. But like I said, fascinating that the Rav says he's not sure we have it, and that it could be that we're going to be like every other nation, that when push comes to shove, when we're given the opportunity, we're going to forget about the higher values and we'll go straight for realpolitik. So for anyone who's concerned, like I said, with the direction of the so-called religious Zionist parties in Israel, party in Israel today, you can listen to this from the Rav. Okay, my friends, we are now looking the last three letters. Let me get my papers here. We had a lot. We did a lot, of course, with Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Rachman, Tavla Meis of Tandu. I noticed that Tamar Ross has an article. It's called "The Trumat HaFeminism LeDiyun HaHalachati," the contribution of feminism to halachic discussions. And on page 44, she says, as one of the problems that feminism has, Orthodox feminism, when it looks at halacha, is Dugma Bayatit Achat. She says, gives this example of Tavla Meis of Tandu, Milameta Varmalu. this is a problem because it's the male voice speaking. And it's an interesting point that she makes that we've discussed. And as I said, you know, you can disagree with Rabbi Rachman, as Rabbi Blech does and others, without even going to this idea that this is a chazaka for all time, because even if you assume that there's a chazaka, chazakas change, it doesn't mean that, you know, a husband, after 10 years of marriage, who refuses to give his wife a get or becomes a wife beater, that means that this existed from the beginning. Found something else interesting. I didn't even realize this. I thought this was something new. I went back and reread Rachman's review essay from the 60s on the Igros Moshe, on Evan Ezra that came out, which he thought was such a significant, for obvious reasons, he thought this was a very significant movement in terms of halacha. And he says, and he talks about what Rav Moshe does, that he voids marriages. But then he says on page 220, he says that Rav Moshe doesn't go as far as he could have gone. And he says that you could have a case where you have an insane husband or all sorts of things where you would say that the presumption that you would prefer a bad marriage to no marriage no longer holds. And then he says that subsequent development of the malady was enough to warrant annulment of the marriage. Insanity, actual potential, is sufficient cause for either spouse not to want the marriage. Sadism, even sadism in refusing to give a get, is also not adequate. He says, why? We now know that almost all neurotic behavior in the circumstances that evoke it cannot be foretold. Insanity is only an extreme form. So he cites this idea. He says that even sadism to refuse to give a get is not good enough reason to void a marriage because we can't foretell the circumstances. So that I think is interesting. So we see movement from Rabbi Rachman. He offers some possibilities of more liberalization. And then he says, though, respectfully, he says, I submit this so that halakhic experts of our day might ponder the problem. So by the end of his life, he wasn't just submitting it for the halakhic experts. Rabbi Rachman thought that they weren't going to do anything and that we have to get involved and do it ourselves. And he says, when a spouse becomes sadistic or vengeful, and we insist on a get in such a case, are we promoting respect for the sanctity of marriage? So he knows, already in his mind, he knows that there should be a way to, if a husband becomes sadistic, a way to get rid of it, to avoid the marriage, even though earlier he said that sadism, since it can't be foretold, apparently you shouldn't be able to get rid of it. So there seems to be a bit of a contradiction here, but it shows you that he's at least thinking of his more radical position. Let's pick up on the next letter. Get out my stuff here. Some pages here. Oh, okay. Letter number 19. Oh, this is an interesting letter. I had never heard of this rabbi before I published the letters, although he's from Canada, I think Montreal. Tzemach Zembrowski. I don't know if he was ever a rav in America, but then I looked him up and he was a leading Mizrahi figure. He writes to the Rav in 1969. He was very much involved in Mizrahi, and Mizrahi and Hapoel Mizrahi actually joined together. And he told the leadership of Mizrahi that the Rav suggested that they form a council of Torah sages, Muetzes Chachmei or Muetzes Gedolia Torah, just like the Aguda has. And so the Mizrahi in Israel, Mizrahi Paul Mizrahi, asked Zembrowski to ask the Rav, well, which rabbi should be on this council of Torah sages? And in response to this, Zembrowski, the Rav tells Zembrowski, you misunderstood me. And he doesn't want a council of Torah sages. He says, Zohi Zachut Miyuchedesh Shel Gudus Yisrael. The idea of a Moetzes Gedolei Torah is something what the Aguda does. We don't do that. What is the Moetzes Gedolei Torah? Moetzes Gedolei Torah is this idea that was invented already from the beginning of the Gudus Yisrael, that all political matters should be decided by the Gedolei Yisrael. Now, how much people will listen to them if they tell you to vote for this or that candidate? We know that not everyone listens, because you can look at the elections in Israel, and you look at the cities, you look at Haredi cities where they're supposed to vote for certain candidates, and they're voting for Ben-Gavir, and they're voting for Likud, they're voting even for Lapid. So we know that they don't always follow this, but at least as the movement, like if they have to make a decision about to join, it continues to stay, to join this government, or what policies do they adopt? It's not for the leadership, the Askanim. They're just the shulchim. They do everything at the beck and call and at the order of the gedolim. So from the very first aguda, they created this Moetzes Gedolei Torah, where the gedolim would come together. They'd go behind closed doors. They'd argue it out. And then they come to a decision, I guess, based on majority, at least that's what's supposed to be. And they come out, and that would then become the Aguda position. And this, there were great disputes. For example, in Marienbad, should Aguda become part of this movement for a state? It was becoming obvious that a state was going to be proclaimed. And if the Aguda wants to have a part of what's going to happen when the state is proclaimed, you need to start getting involved and having input. And every issue under the sun would go to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. The problems were apparent from the beginning with the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, because you had the Gedolei Yisrael, that is great Torah scholars, Lithuanians, but it's not just Torah scholars, because you also need to have individuals who have great influence. So you could have great Torah scholars who would not be put on it, but from Lita, at least, the ones who are put on were great Torah scholars. But then you have the Hasidish Rebbe's. Take Poland. Poland is Hasidic. And you have the Ger Rebbe, who they say there was about 250,000 Ger Hasidim, or fellow travelers in Poland. That made him the most important political voice in Poland for the Jewish community. So you need to have the various Rebbe's on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, because they have the influence. Now, from a Litvish perspective, this is going to create a problem, because as we all know, being a great Torah scholar is not a job requirement for being a Rebbe. Some of them have been great Torah scholars, but you don't need to be a great Torah scholar to be a Rebbe. And this is how really eventually it would split in Israel. They say at least for Shach, that was his major reason. So if you're a great Torah scholar, you're supposed to have the same vote as someone who's there because his father was a Rebbe and he has many followers. From Rav Shach's perspective, if we're Torah scholars, we have the majority. It doesn't matter who they are. So that was always going to be a problem with the Aguda, although the movement kept together for a number of decades. The other problem, and this goes back already also decades, and it continues, is that the Moetzes Gedolei Torah in Israel, America is like a small version of it, they reached a point where the Moetzes Gedolei Torah stopped functioning and was irrelevant, and it remains irrelevant today. At a certain point, I don't know when you can date this, I think to the 70s, certainly by the 80s, the Aguda, I don't know, not the organization itself, because they still went through the motions. Now they didn't go through the motions anymore, but they adopted, the people at least adopted what I call the papal model. That is, instead of lots of gedolim, the idea developed, and that's been for now for decades, that there is one Das Torah, one Gadol Yisrael. And there's an expectation. When the Gadol passes away, let's say Rabbi Yosef passes away, the question is then, who is the successor? And there always has to be a successor. Sometimes there could be a Machokas. Is it Rav Shmuel Auerbach or is it Rav Steinman? But there's always the assumption that there has to be a successor. And Rav Steinman passes away, so then it's you have a new successor in B'nai Brak. And they were usually very elderly in the 80s or 90s before it was Rav Shach. When Rav Shach passes away, it's Rav Yoshev. So the idea that there's a Moetzes Gedolei Torah, you see the same in the Sephardic world also when they adopted this model. The idea, though, that you'd have all the Gedolim come together and discuss and vote, that has not been accepted for decades already now. And there's an assumption from the people that when the Gedol dies, the Gedol, the Gadol Hador, that he will be replaced by another one. So, and you can see this again and again when he's Nifter. Then it comes from the bottom up, although the Askanim do a lot to whoever controls Yated Ne'aman is very important in this. They proclaim who the next authority is. And Rav Kanievsky, for instance, proclaimed that Rav Steinman is now the Gadol. And everything else. So it's no longer Moetzes Gedolei Torah. It's one, as I said, it's like a papal model that there can only be one Torah scholar, which was not the original Aguda approach. Okay, so the Rav writes to Zembrowski. Zembrowski obviously misunderstood what the Rav was speaking to him, no doubt, or speaking to him together with other rabbis, and the Rav expressed an opinion, and Zembrowski thought that the Rav wanted a Moetzes Gedolei Torah. There were people who wanted this. What is the role supposed to be for the rabbis with the Mizrahi? Rav Kook, for instance, during the early years of his chief rabbinate in the 20s, the issue came up, or actually, sorry, his 30s already, of the women voting. And Rav Kook comes out against women voting. This is for the elections. The Jewish Agency had elections, the Vat HaLumi. And Rav Maimon, who was one of the leaders of Mizrahi, said, with all due respect to Rav Kook, and he was a great supporter of Rav Kook, when it comes to halachic matters, we will ask Rav Kook. But when it comes to matters of life, we don't need to ask the rabbis. And whether women should vote or not, is not these are not matters that the rabbis need to weigh in on. So the Mizrahi had always pushed back against this. So what was the Rav's position? The Rav says that what I said is something Shona Lagamri, something completely different. He says, if Talmidei Chachamim, people focused on Torah study, are connected to this movement, the Mizrahi movement, that's what they're loyal to, he says, that is therefore the obligation of the movement to be in touch with them. La'amodim ha'mekesher v'masa matan, regarding difficult matters, political matters, social matters. Not that the Rabbanim make a decision, and it's Das Torah, and everyone has to listen. But know that before the decisions are made, just like the politicians discuss with each other, so too they have to take counsel from the rabbis. If you tell me, on the other hand, that the opinion of the scholars, the Torah scholars, is meaningless, it's just like anyone else's opinion, then why are we involved with this movement? In other words, the Rav assumes that rabbis rabbis have what to say. They're Talmidei Chachamim. They're not just like everyone else. They have valuable opinions, and on all important issues, they should be consulted. Does this mean that they have a veto? No. However, they give, just like on all important matters, it's nice to speak it over with a rabbi. They'll have insight. They'll express opinion. They'll call attention to matters that you might be unaware of, that it could be a chil Hashem. There might be halachic matters that come into play, or hashkafic matters. Basically, if you respect the rabbis, then all important decisions should be in consultation with them. And you never know. It could be that there will be times when the rabbis say, absolutely, this is forbidden. You can't do it. But generally, that's not the case when dealing with political matters. And that's never been the case until the Aguda came up with the idea of Moetzes Gedolei Torah. There never was an assumption that you always had communities and leadership, and both in local communities and in even some places, the Vat Arba Arts, the entire nation, there never was this assumption that the rabbis had veto authority and could decide. You had Zion Tov Ha'ir. But it was expected that the rabbis would have input. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik says here. And he says, "In ein sorach b'talmidei chachamim, lama nanu hilachem ba'ada? If Mizrahi has no use for talmidei chachamim, why are we," he's really speaking about himself, "putting our reputations on the line, fighting for Mizrahi?" Remember, the rabbis associated with Mizrahi were fighting. They had to fight an ideological battle against all these other rabbanim, including Gedolei Yisrael, who were saying, you should not be with that movement. You, talmidei chachamim, you Rav Soloveitchik, how could you be in such a movement? They don't value Torah scholars there. So all the Talmidei Chachamim who are fighting for the Mizrahi position, why should they continue doing this if their opinion is not taken into account? Now, you might answer, what do you mean? Because they believe in the Mizrahi ideology. But the Rav's point is that the Mizrahi, for it to be regarded as a religious Zionist movement, not just the Zionist movement, a religious Zionist movement, religious movements need to have consultation with rabbis. This doesn't mean rabbis are the final word and make decisions on everything, but you need consultation. Rav Lichtenstein also, he has an essay explaining Das Torah. What's our attitude to Das Torah? And he expresses the exact same view that Rav expresses here, that consultation is important. But we don't give up our autonomy. And obviously in the modern Orthodox world, the root of Zionist world, no one's giving up their autonomy. If you feel that Yair Lapid is the best person for the state of Israel, then you're going to vote for him. And the idea that any rabbi is going to tell you not to, it's unheard of in our communities. I don't think any rabbi in a religious Zionist modern Orthodox show who get up and tell the community who they should vote for senator or president would last very long in his office. The idea of autonomy, personal autonomy on these matters is not only is it taken seriously, it's seen almost like a sacred idea that we have freedom of thought and we can vote for who we wish to. In the Agudo world, on the contrary, for the important, you can decide if you want to paint your house blue or green, but for the important decisions, and they've even had literature where they say for important decisions, you know, the Gedolim have to make that. So that's his letter. Fascinating. And that what I just read you is where Rabbi Helfgott ends. But the letter continues. And I want to share with you what it says. And maybe some of the three names I'm going to mention, some of you know who I'm talking about. And if maybe even the three names I mentioned, you people listening are those people. Because remember, we saw with Alan Solomon, where the Rav wrote to, was it Kirschbaum, saying that one of the important families in our town, the son is in this kibbutz, and he doesn't know about Torah Judaism. Can you invite him? We have another example, writing to Zembrowski, where the Rav is, again, expressing concern. He says, Derech Agav, he says, I ask you to extend yourself for three students, Talmidot, girl students at the Hebrew University, and to make sure that they spend the Pesach holiday, it says, Ikari Ikari, especially the night of the Seder, because at the end of the day, lots of college students in America were back at university for the final days of Yom Tov. And Chabad, or the Orthodox, JOIC, whatever, they put on the meals because they had to be there during Chol Hamoed. But for the Seders, so you can have it in Israel, but the Seders, of course, everyone went home. So he says, certainly for the Seders, make sure they have somewhere to go. These girls are from Boston, from wonderful families. B'nai Batim, he says, Mehudarim. Full of atzilut. So who are the three girls? Let me know. You can type it in. Does anyone know who they are? These will be the maiden names, but maybe one of you was listening to us. Tamar Sivan from Boston. I don't know. Chaya Gvurin and Rachel Lightman. These are the three religious girls from 1969 from a wonderful families of Boston who the Rav reaching out to make sure they have a place to spend Pesach. So if any of you know who these were, please let us know. I'm sure the girls probably don't even know that they were mentioned by the Rav. That is letter 19. Letter 20 gets us into a whole story, a whole Megillah for itself, namely Rav Soloveitchik and the Chief Rabbinate. Rav Soloveitchik, we mentioned already, in 1935, he goes to Eretz Yisrael. He never called it, incidentally, Yisrael. He always called it Eretz Yisrael. For some reason, he had this, he says, he explains in an essay we'll see in a few minutes. He says, I've never called the Medina, the Eretz HaKodesh, Yisrael. He says, I don't want to explain my reasons, but I never called it, he says, and when he sends a letter to Israel, he doesn't say Yisrael. He calls it Medinat Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. So one of the two. I think that's what he means. He says, Ani koteb min kom Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. Unless he wrote Medinat Yisrael and underneath it, Eretz Yisrael. But he never said Yisrael. And he doesn't explain why he had a problem calling it Israel as opposed to Medinat Yisrael. I guess If I had to speculate, because Yisrael refers to the Jewish people, refers to a religious collection, and the state of Israel, for all its significance, is full of irreligiosity and full of non-Torah things. So you don't want to call that Yisrael. Although I think Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook would challenge that even when the Jewish people were doing all sorts of sins, they still were called Yisrael. So you have the good and the bad. But so he would never call it that. So he goes to Eretz Yisrael, Palestine, 935. He spends a number of months. One of his children was Tova, I believe it was born when he was in Eretz Yisrael. Makes a big impression. Doesn't become chief rabbi. Then Rav Herzog dies in 1959, and there's a great movement to draft Rabbi Soloveitchik as chief rabbi. There were really only two contenders at that time. One was Rabbi Unterman, Rav Yisrael Yehuda Unterman. He was Rav of Tel Aviv after Rav Amiel dies. Rav Amiel dies in 46, as I recall. Not very old. Rav Unterman, who had been serving as Rav in Liverpool, England, the Beatles city, Liverpool, where he learned English. So that's good. He is called to Tel Aviv, and he is like after Rav Herzog, he's the leading Mizrahi Rav, I would say, in the world, together with Soloveitchik, and he's a posik, writing Shelos and Chuvos, and he's living already in Eretz Yisrael, and then later the State of Israel, publicly identified with Mizrahi. So he's going to be the candidate of the official, like, Mizrahi, many of the official Mizrahi types. But the ones who are more intellectual, you might want to say more sophisticated, because it's not like all the Israeli religious academics and the ones who knew the Rav from Europe, they all supported the Rav. So before I get to the letter of Rav Soloveitchik explaining why he didn't choose one of a few letters, I want to give you a little more background as well, because there's a backstory here. I was told by Professor Alexander Altman, who comes, I forget now. I have to look it up. He was the communal rabbi in Manchester. He came and became professor of Brandeis University. I'll just check right now. What, 1959. Okay. He, in 1959, he comes and, becomes a rabbi, becomes professor of Brandeis. For 20 years, he was the rabbi of Manchester. The Minchas Yitzhak, or Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, was on his base. And before that, he was one of the leading rabbis in Berlin. I was not a student of him, but I interviewed him twice when he retired in the early 80s. So I didn't never knew him, but twice I went to interview him because he's a student of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. He's an example of someone who had a very impressive career in the rabbinate, but gave it up to have a more relaxed career without Baal HaBatim in the academic world. He suffered a lot in Manchester because Manchester had always had many Haredim. And he tried to create like an institute for academic Jewish studies, just like they did in Berlin. And the Haredim came after him, and they wanted to, they even wanted to put him in Cheirim. For this sort of thing. So I guess he decided to give it all up. And he comes to America. He told me that he was once in the Rav's house. So this would have been around 1959, shortly after he came to Boston. And while he was there, a telegram comes to the Rav, signed by a lot of big Rabbanim. And we'll see who some of them could have been soon. I'll show you urging him to accept the chief rabbinate. As part of the backstory, I want to share with you a letter, as far as I know, unknown. It's a letter from Shlomo Zalman Shragai. Shragai, who he was mayor of Jerusalem. We mentioned him already, and a leading Mizrahi figure from 1959, November 26th, to Rav Soloveitchik. And he writes to him as follows. It gives you a sense of what's going on in Israel. He says, I'm going to tell you what the situation is going on here, and also concerning your aliyah to Israel. He says, Rov HaMachria, the overwhelming majority of religious Zionist Jews, well, he says religious Jews in Israel. He's referring to the Zionist Jews, because in those days, the Haredim had no involvement, what we today call Haredim. They weren't called that then. in the Chief Rabbinate. And there really weren't many of so-called Haredim. The people in Hebron Yeshiva, they were very much interested in the Chief Rabbinate. The Chazon Ish's group, who wouldn't be interested, it's really a very small group in the 50s. He says the majority, the clear majority of religious Jews, even those who are not members of Mizrahi, see you as the one and only person, the one who should come to Israel and accept upon himself the Chief Rabbinate. And they believe that you will be successful in all ways. There is a portion, and he says, in my opinion, this is a small group, that inclines to a Muhammad Acher, to another candidate. That is Rav Unterman. He says, a few days ago, I met with the Rosh Memshala, that's Ben-Gurion, and he asked me who I think should be the chief rabbi. I replied that, in my opinion, it should be you, Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Ben-Gurion said to me, but he's not a Zionist. He's living his whole life. He's living in Chutz Laaretz. How could Rabbi Soloveitchik be the chief rabbi if he's not a Zionist? And from Lo Asan Nisayon Lo Haaretz, and he's never made any attempt to come to the land of Israel. He also said that as Ben Gurion said, that you, Rav Soloveitchik, your discussion with the reporter of Yediot Ahronot, if what's reported is correct, made a very bad impression in what you discuss Aliyah to the land of Israel. Aliyah to Israel. So what's this business of who's this reporter and what's the Yediot? So let me in on a secret here. The reporter is none other, maybe it's not a secret. The reporter is none other than Eli Wiesel. And I'm holding in front of me, which I found, which I got the Yediot Ahronot. I didn't find it actually. Menachem Butler sent it to me. He has all sorts of good stuff from November 13th, 1959, an interview with Rav Soloveitchik and Eliezer Wiesel, who's the correspondent in America. And this interview has lots of things in it, so much so that the Rav was forced to issue a retraction. The Rav wrote an essay, Ahavat HaTorah Ugulat Nefesh HaDor, concerning the love of Torah and redemption of the soul of the generation. As far as I know, this has never been translated into English. I'm looking at it from the book in Besod HaYachid VaHayachad. And Rav Lichtenstein said that this essay is the best short presentation of the Rav's approach, his ideological approach to Torah, than anything else. So it definitely should be translated. However, before you get to where the Rav starts speaking about substantive matters, he speaks about his interview with Eli Wiesel. This essay was originally published in Hadoah. Hadoah was the writer of the newspaper of the Jewish intellectuals, the Maskilim, the open-minded religious in the late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. If you look in the 50s and 60s, the Rav published important stuff there. He published his eulogy for Rav Chaim Heller in Hadoah. This is not an Orthodox publication. It's one that's friendly to tradition, but not all the writers were observant Jews the way we think about it. But so the Rav already, we see he was involved with this, but a lot of people were. Anyone who was Hebraist published for them. So he begins clarifying that, first of all, two things that Eli Wiesel says, he never could have said it. And, you know, reporters, his attitude is reporters always make mistakes. He never could have called it Yisrael, I mentioned. And also, Eli Wiesel has the Rav speaking about Mashiachiyut, messianism. And he says, I never have used that term. We believe in Emunat HaMashiach, but this idea of messianism, Mashiachiyut, is not a term I ever have used. And then he gets to talking about important stuff. He doesn't say anything about the criticism of Ben-Gurion, what he said about Aliyah, and which makes a bad impression. So what so Shargai says, so what did the Rav say about Aliyah? I'll read it to you. I'm going to get my magnifying glass here because I can find it. It's the printout I have is very small. I don't have it on the screen. The Rav says as follows. Elie Wiesel, and the Rav didn't deny this. So presumably Elie Wiesel is quoting accurately. I asked the Rav, this is Elie Wiesel, what about Jewish youth going on Aliyah to Israel? The Rav says, Zechalo. It's a dream. It's never going to happen. American Jews are not going to go on Aliyah. Chalom? I said a chalom? And the Rav says, yes, it's a good dream. Chalom yafeh. But I doubt that it will ever come to pass. He says, and he's not just speaking on Orthodox, he's speaking on all American Jews. He says the young and the Jews included don't feel themselves drawn to Israel. So it's talking about El Yisrael. So he never would have said El Yisrael. He would have said El Medina Yisrael. He says like they used to be drawn to it. They're interested in what's going on and they'll assist, but they're not going to live there. And what's the reason? He says that there's a new approach from the American Jewish community to the state of Israel. He says, I remember when I was a young man and the Eretz Yisrael was a chavaya pnimit amuka. It wasn't just a geographical place or a religious place. It was a spiritual thing. It affected me to the core. When I heard the name Eretz Yisrael, it would bring up, it would have an effect on all my bones. And when a shliach from Eretz Yisrael came to us, we would kiss his garb. But he says, so then Elie Wiesel says, who's responsible that people don't want to go on Aliyah? Rav Soloveitchik didn't answer. He doesn't want to criticize others. He only added that Ben Gurion doesn't understand how important religion is to the Jewish people, and only through religion can we bring them back. So you see here that the Rav, look, he was being realistic. He was saying that the idea. I know that when my aunt, who was a teenager, I guess it would have been in late 50s, Ben Gurion came to America. I think it was Ben Gurion. And she must have been, I don't know which youth group she was in, but they had a meeting they went to see the great prime minister, and he told them they should all go to Israel, even if their parents oppose it. You know, they all should come, and when they're 18, they could do what they want. They should all leave America and go to Israel. And that was the ideology. Hey, when I was in Israel, my year in Israel, we were being indoctrinated left and right in my yeshiva, BMT. Go to Israel, go to Israel. And I remember my friend went to Gush for one Shabbos. And Rav Lichtenstein was in. I went to Gush one Shabbos. Rav Amital was there that Shabbos. He went, Rav Lichtenstein was there. And they had like a Shalosh Shudas, ask the rabbi. So someone gets up and says he really wants to stay in Eretz Yisrael, Mitzvah Zisha of Eretz Yisrael, but his parents are pressuring him to go back to America. What should he do? If that was at BMT where I was, they'd say, you know what you need to do. And Mitzvah Zisha of Eretz Yisrael was Docha Kibbut Avein. You know what Rav Lichtenstein said to him? Go back to America. Make your parents happy. Go to YU because that's what you need. And after you finish YU, get a college education and come to Israel. Why do you have to cause your parents sorrows? Eretz Yisrael the state of Israel is still going to be here after 4 years. So exactly what I told my son when he was pressuring me, wanted to go to Rav Shurlo's yeshiva last year after 2 years in Israel and do Hesder. And I said, nope, it's not happening. You want to go... come back. He goes, go to YU where he is. And then when you're done, you can go to Israel. And that's still his plan. But I remember my friend came back and told us this. We thought this was amazing and that's why we had this one guy at BMT who said Rav Lichtenstein is not a real Zionist. He said that not because of this. He said this because of his view that you can give back certain land. But I guess it all goes together. It's a realistic position. Your parents are going crazy. They're so upset. You're too young. At 17, 18, you're going to stay in Israel. Go back home, and then you'll come back. There was this thinking, though, from the Zionist movement that all Jews would come to Israel. And many Jews did come, but they came, the survivors, from the war, the ones from the Arab world. We have had a great Aliyah from America, but that's not in the 50s. That's post-67. And it's an Aliyah of Orthodox Jews, both Haredi, Don't let anyone tell you Haredim don't love Eretz Yisrael. The Medina, they're not crazy about, but Eretz Yisrael, they have a high percentage, I would think, than the modern Orthodox. Actually, I don't know, but it's definitely similar. And there's been a huge immigration of the people listening to us. It's probably every one of you or every other one. You have a child or definitely a nephew or a niece who's living in Israel. So, but that's all post 67. In the 50s, you didn't have much in the way of Aliyah. It was a very difficult country. How you can make a living in Israel in those days? You have to be a real believer to go there. But Ben-Gurion was very upset with this. Shragai continues. Ben-Gurion didn't say any more. This letter, which I'm reading for you now, I have the manuscript. I didn't publish it. In retrospect, I made a mistake. I should have included this letter in as a preface to the letter of the Rav and the Chief Rabbinate, because I think it's very insightful. He says, but I understood from Ben-Gurion's words that he doesn't oppose it. He's not in opposition to you. Later, Ben-Gurion, or was even before this, maybe, I forget what year Ben-Gurion comes to America, he goes to YU. There's a famous picture of him sitting next to Belkin and the Rav with a yarmulke on his head. It's very unusual to see Ben-Gurion with a yarmulke. He wore hats when he needed to, but he never would put on a yarmulke. But there he has a yarmulke, as I recall. You can find the picture. In fact, I'll find it later. And he met with the Rav. So he says, I understood from him that he's not opposed. But we have to just talk more to him with that. And Shazar, who wasn't president then, Ben Zvi was president, he's chairman of the Jewish Agency, he says Shazar is speaking to him. And Shargai says, it appears to me that what's going to be determinative is if our movement, Mizrahi, is in the government or not. Then he says, you should have, when in speaking to Elie Wiesel, you should have spoken about what can be done to encourage Aliyah. You say that it's a chalom, but you don't say what we can do to make the chalom a mitziyut. And then he says, you say that it's because there's no religious connection. They're not religiously connected to the land of Israel. And he says, same about the religious community, not just the Jewish community as a whole. He says, and not just the Tori Karta and the Gudas Yisrael, but even our people, Mizrahi, he's talking in the 50s, Mizrahi people in America, enam olim la'aretz, and that's a fact. Religious Zionism in America came to mean philanthropy, not that you actually go on Aliyah. This would only become a reality post-67. He says, if there's a little bit of Aliyah, what is it? He says, 600, 700 people a year. And then he says, of those people, 80% who come to Israel are not religious, and 20% of the ones who come to Israel are not coming from our group. They're coming from the Chuge Admorim v'Chasidim. So basically he's saying there's no Aliyah from Mizrahi. And he says, I want to tell you what's the situation. Okay. Despite Ben-Gurion's hesitation, in the end, it was clear that the Rav could have the Chief Rabbinate if he wanted it. So why didn't he take it? We will see next class. First of all, we'll see a few of his letters published in the Helfgott book, and then we'll see what he writes to Reuven Katz. Helfgott publishes a translation of some of this letter, what appeared in Hador. But until I published it, this is the first time that the complete letter from the Rav to Rav Reuven Katz ever appeared in print. So we get good insight on the Rav, who so much wanted to go to the Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s, and he lost in the late 50s, early 60s, when he could have gone, he hesitated. And in the end, he decided he wasn't going to go. So that's what we'll pick up next class. I thought we might actually even get to that letter. So not only see that, we're also going to get into the issue next class of Machitza. The Rav's correspondence with Marvin Fox about the situation in Columbus, because that's a huge issue, Machitza. I'll offer my approach as to why I think the Rav was so important in dividing the Orthodox movement from Orthodoxy from the conservative movement. And it was the Rav, I think, who for our communities made Machitza really the identifying mark of what an Orthodox shul is. So I'll give you some very interesting facts next time about what other rabbis have to say on this matter. So let me take some of the questions. If anyone wants to, Nikki, yes, you unmute yourself. No, you're muted. No, you got to press the button. Hold on. Can you unmute yourself? Okay, if you can unmute yourself, I don't think I can unmute you. I think you need to unmute yourself.
I can, but I think, hold on, let me see if I can do it. If you don't do it yourself, give me a second.
It says ask to unmute. Oh, she's unmuted.
I have a problem. I have a problem. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you. We can hear you. Yes.
I remember, I went to Israel on the first Machon Mekayetz, which was in 54 or 55. And I decided I wanted to stay. And I wrote home in the little aerogram, the blue aerogram folded up thing that I was staying. And my mother wrote me back the only letter that would keep me there, bring me home, which was, listen, you're just another mouth to feed. You're no good for Israel at this point. Come home, get an education, and then go back. And it was true. I mean, it was all chatzilim at that point. It was a very difficult situation for Israelis. And I would have been just another mouth to feed. So that was yes, that. And the other thing that I wanted to say is I was around. I remember my parents talking to Rav Soloveitchik when he was thinking about being chief rabbi. And they begged him not to do it, because they said he would be eaten alive by the politicians in Israel. And this was a very hot discussion with him at the time. And I know that there was a very strong feeling here that he would be, they would just eat him alive and make his life miserable.
Well, we're going to see exactly the Rav basically says that. He blames it on the politicians. Oh. That he, so we'll see that next class where the Rav explains that basically he couldn't be a Rav there. He would have had to be a politician. Now, your other point is, yes, you had, let's say, in the late 40s, early 50s, you had, first of all, the Jews, the survivors. You had the Jews who were able to get out of the communist countries and from the Arab countries. So it was very difficult. But by the late 1950s, it still was, the economy was terrible, socialists and all that, and it was not easy. But the state of Israel was on a massive propaganda measure to bring in Jews from around the world, saying you all should come from Latin America, from the United States. And that's why, like I said, my aunt was told, you know, come to Israel. We'll work it out when you get here, what's going to be. And that was what the Rav was saying. It's not going to happen. They're not going to come just like that. And there was a big surprise for many people. Someone privately says whether the Rav was inclined to Aguda, Aguda was clearly not inclined to the Rav, as evidenced by your text demonstrating an erasure of his photo with Rav Aaron Cutler. Well, the erasure of the photo with Rav Aaron Cutler, which everyone can see in my book, Changing the Immutable, happened that's after the fact. That's when the Rav had already joined Mizrahi and had abandoned the yeshiva, the Haredi position on this. But we're talking in the 1930s and 1940s. So obviously, once the Rav officially joins Mizrahi, he's breaking with the so-called Das Torah, so then they wouldn't have. And I don't know if that's the Aguda not being inclined. There were many people. Moshe Feinstein was like the unofficial leader of Aguda. I think they gave him even the title as honorary president. And you had many other people in Aguda, Rav Ruderman. Rav Ruderman and the Rav were very, very close friends. Rav Moshe was very close friends with the Rav. I mean, family, for that matter. So you had many people in Aguda, in America. Rav Gifter was very respectful to the Rav. In some Aguda circles, they were not so respectful to the Rav. But some of these were in Israel, not in America. I think for the most part, the Gedolim were pretty much all respectful. You had second level rabbis in America who were not respectful. And then you had Balabatim who, what can you say about Balabatim? They, you know, they think they're, you know, they rather than sitting and learning a Bat Gemara, they like to sit in the back of the base medrash and get all the Lashon Hara. So, you know, those people are Einam Malim v'Einam Maridim. You know, they don't count for anything. So I would not say that Aguda, now they have a difficult relationship with him because he's one of theirs and leaves. And we see that with the Jewish Observer eulogy. But I dare say that none of the Gedolim ever would have written that way. That was written by politicians who wanted to show respect for Soloveitchik, but not too much respect, and they didn't want to legitimize his involvement with Mizrahi. So how do you praise someone for being a great Torah scholar without also legitimizing him being a part of Mizrahi and YU? They never have a problem about the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe thinks that the Aguda approach borders on Kafira, but yet they can praise him without any ifs, ands, or buts. For some reason, it's a problem with the Rav. I think in my mind, it shows a lack of intellectual maturity. Why can't they just say he's one of the greatest Gedolim? We disagree on this matter. It's for some reason they have this problem when it comes to people like Rav Soloveitchik. I think it comes from a lack of their own self-confidence. If they know they can praise the Satmar Rebbe as much as they want, then their Baal HaBatim are not going to become Satmar. But if they actually say who the Rav was and what made him so great, all of a sudden, their Baal HaBatim are going to start reading the Rav. The next thing you know, their attitude is going to be like, hey, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's right on the mark here. And that'll be undermining Das Torah. So I get the problem. Let me tell you something else. As long as I mention it, I will show you the evidence of this in a future blog post. But this is not known either. Everyone looks at the Jewish Observer and attacks them and says what they did is so terrible. No one knows the real story. Well, now you'll know it. Rav Shach had given the order that there was to be no mention of the Rav's passing at all. They went against Rav Shach. So when you look at what the Jewish Observer did, rather than looking at what they didn't say, like Rav Tendor, he turns into he says that the person who wrote this lost his share in Olam Haba. I think you have to look at the bravery it actually took to go against Rav Shach, who was at that time was their Das Torah. And what they wrote, it was not a simple thing to do what they did. And so one day I'll show you how my evidence of this. I have the actual evidence. So Nissen says, the thought of the Rav on oppression contains the seed of his call decades later for the Khan Commission formation of Sabra Shatila. Yes, the Rav always felt, you know, it's not realpolitik perhaps, but the, you know, religious Jews have to be moral exemplars. It's hard. How do you run a state? You know, get your hands dirty, as it were, and be a moral exemplar. Something sometimes you have to, realpolitik causes you to get your hands dirty. But maybe that's why the Rav couldn't be a politician. Yes, the Rav did call for that. He said that he would even resign from Mizrahi if they didn't. You know, Begin said about Sabra Shatila, Goyim kill Goyim and they blame the Jews. But the Rav thought that we need to, what do they say about Caesar's wife? Beyond even the, what's the expression of, something of impropriety, beyond even the hint of impropriety. So the Rav, one of the letters we'll get to in two questions, I think, is the letter to Meir Kahana, the forged letter, so as it were, to Meir Kahana. And we'll talk about the Rav's position on that. Nissen says, Poel Aguda broke from Aguda in 1940 over the issue of subservience to Moetzis. Brotherly relations were nevertheless maintained, and they ran together for many years. They did, but they did also break. Poel Aguda Yisrael would join the government with Rabbi Kalman Kahana in the 50s, I think it is, and that brings down the Stipler and others. The condemnations on them are just as harsh, if not harsher, than on Mizrahi. So Poel Aguda did go together with them, and you're right, they did break from Aguda. They thought that the Aguda was not concerned with the workers, but they'd make peace. But there was a time when they broke with them, and they had their own rabbi. Poel Aguda Yisrael had their own rabbanim and the journal Mayan.
If I can just add, because I got this from leaders in Pi of in Israel, what happened was Itchamayah Levin, who was, you know, the Gera Rebbe's brother-in-law, the son-in-law of the previous Gera Rebbe of his time, the first minister of welfare, he offered Ben-Gurion his resignation over the Giyot Banot issue. And the way it was explained to me is that he was shocked when it was accepted. So what you're saying, Professor Mark, is correct, that Poel Aguda remained in the government. Binyamin Mintz was the minister of posts. He was the leader of Poel Aguda and Rav Kalman Kahana, the Rav of Chofetz Chaim. He was also together with him. But they all joined the first government together, but when Ishmael Evans, according to Lerucha, when his reservation was accepted by Ben Gurion, Palei Agudah stayed. And that was, I think, what you're referring to.
But then, and Binyamin Mintz was persecuted. It probably caused his early death. He couldn't go to, when he would go to shuls, no one would want to have anything to do with him. Because he also, as I recall, was a Ger Chassid in that circle. Yes. Mike says that Chaim Moser had the Gadol title. He did have the Gadol title, but there still was a Moetzes, and they still met. You look at Marienbad and you see there was back and forth and huge disputes between Rabbi Chanan, for instance, and Rabbi Chaim Moser, as well as with, you have Rabbi Tzurelsin, you had many other Gedolim. So he didn't have final authority even on Aguda political matters. He never had that the way that they would have today. And Nissen says, or Chaim Moser, in his understanding, used the term Das Torah to refer to the opinion of the yeshivos that he represents as the yeshivos. Mike says, Mizrahi rabbis make political endorsements. You can make political endorsements. That's not Das Torah, though. Today, I think we would say we perhaps don't want rabbis to make political endorsements. But when Rav Lichtenstein went to Israel, I don't know if he came to this lightly, but he thought that it was important for there to be a more moderate, because if you have Tzvi Yehuda Cook and the Gush Emunim representing religious Zionism, he thought that there needs to be a different perspective. And so he's also a private person. He's a Rosh Yeshiva. You know what they do when they do these endorsements. They say, this does not represent the yeshiva. This is my private endorsement. And there never was an understanding that this is Das Torah, and if you don't follow it, you're sinning or anything like that. None of that rhetoric. So I don't, it's not, it's definitely not the same. Das Torah is a religious requirement that you have to vote this way. That's how it's framed by the leaders. And for Rav Lichtenstein, it's simply expressing an opinion, like the Rav's approach. This is my opinion. I'm going to try to convince you of it. If it makes sense to you, fine. If it doesn't, then you go your own way. Samuel, thank you. So Tamar Simon Simone, let me get the name here again. Tamar, he has written here Tamar Sivan. Is that a mistake? That you say it's Tamar Simon is the daughter of Simon Maimon. It could be a mistake here that the Rav has, that we have here, he wrote Sivan, or it's it was a typed letter. So maybe the person who typed it made a mistake instead of Sivan Simon. It should have been interesting. So Yocheved, we have a, is that a translation of On the Love of Torah and the Redemption of This Generation? Someone's going to have to tell me if that's a translation of the essay or just a discussion of it on the Torah Musings blog. Partial translation. Very nice. I don't know if Aguda is really Satmar at heart, but maybe. Herb says, my information was that the Rav's wife was told she would have to cover hair as the wife of the chief rabbi, and she refused. She apparently also was opposed to him accepting the position. All those things could be part of it. But at the end of the day, the Rav explains in a way that makes perfect sense why he doesn't want to take the position as chief rabbinate, the politics. We'll see that next class. David says, how much was Rashach's negative attitude towards the Rav informed by his one son becoming a Mizrahi supporter and enrolling in Revel, where he obtained a PhD in Jewish thought? I always thought this might explain his negative attitude, that his son ends up going to the Rav, to the YU. Not the Rav, he wasn't a Musmach of YU, but that his son becomes a Mizrahi and goes to YU. So I thought maybe that had something to do with it, even before you mentioned that, David. In fact, I said it to someone a couple of weeks ago. Someone asked privately, how do you explain why there were almost no one from the Aguda camp at the Rav's funeral? It was Erev Yom Tov. So that explains why, let's say, the Feinsteins weren't there. They came later to the memorial at YU. But even if it wasn't then, there was a ban that came out. There was an official ban, or unofficial ban, I should say, in the yeshiva world to go. So I wouldn't say Agudas. There was plenty of people, Aguda supporters, who would have gone and even went to the funeral. However, the yeshiva world, the yeshiva welt, the Haredi yeshiva welt, the more extreme Haredi yeshiva welt, they chose not to go. I'm talking Lakewood, Philadelphia. It's very disappointing, Lakewood, knowing the Rav's close personal connection, not just to Rav Aaron, and the Rav Aaron would call the Rav when he needed assistance. We already saw this, but we're for Schneier. The Rav had a very close relationship with Rav Schneier. When Rav Aaron Cutler dies, the Rav comes to the funeral, and he was ready to give a hespate. As far as I know, we don't know what happened to this hespate, but they didn't let him. If you read Hapardes, there's a big protest that they didn't let the Rav give a hespate, but maybe in the archives of the Rav somewhere, we have this hespate, because it would be fascinating to see the hespate of Rav Aaron. We know a little bit of what he thought from the talk he gave at the Chinuch Atzmai. But the after, in the Allgemeiner Journal, there was a back and forth after the Rav's funeral with some bozo trying to explain, you know, why we couldn't go to the Rav's funeral. And that's what led to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's very angry article in the Allgemeiner, which I published. And look, it's very disappointing. It's very upsetting. It's not the fine moment in the life of the Haredi world. And it would not happen today. Today, many of them respect the Rav, and we have many of the Rav's students from the 70s who are part and parcel of that word. The Rav's world, the Rav's Torah is studied in that world. But at the end of the day, they just simply could not move beyond this. They simply didn't know what it meant to give kavod to someone who disagreed with them. Very much different than Rav Chaim. When Rav Moliver, the head of Chovav Eitz Zion, religious Zionism, dies in the early part of the 20th century, Reb Chaim goes, says, I'm going to the funeral. And people said, how could you go to the funeral? You were so opposed to him. And Reb Chaim said, and this is recorded by the Briskers, he says that we can disagree in matters, in political matters, but I still have to respect the Gadol B'Yisrael and Torah. And therefore, we separate the two. And unfortunately, they did not have that perspective. Okay, that leads us to the end today. We will pick up, like I said, next week with the Rav and the Chief Rabbinate, and we'll get to Mechitza as well. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Thank you. I don't know if you saw, you know, I had to leave for the last, 8 minutes, so I just got back, I guess, in perfect timing, but thank you very much. So I'm actually out of breath, but okay. Anyways, okay. Yasher Koach, I didn't hear what you said at the end, but lots of interesting stuff. And thank you, everybody. And please, God, we'll see you next week. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman and Dr. Sokolow are back. We'll be sending out sort of our new classes will be starting next week. And we'll let you know by email. But thank you very much. And everybody should be well and have a happy occasion. As we mentioned at the beginning, especially being Yom HaShoah, that we should, the school of our learning should, I don't know, there's nothing I can say. You know, I went to Auschwitz only in 2015. We went to Poland. I went to Poland for the first time, and it's like a speechless thing. It's like, it's unbelievable. And I just, how we'll commemorate it in 25 years from now. I told my students today at chat, their kids aren't going to know any survivors. And a lot of them are grandchildren or great grandchildren, really depending of survivors. And we're reaching the end of that generation. So I don't know. But anyways, I just figured it's something important to mention. And I'm sorry if I don't, my words are not adequate. But anyways, we should have good times. And Mark, what you said before on the Rav's comment, you were still here, that my son always liked to talk about that. We didn't have the ability to oppress for 2,000 years. And let's hope that we don't take advantage now that we do have that ability. I think that's such a powerful statement of the Rav and such what he was referring to, that, you know, who knows if we'll be different. And if we're not, that's a little scary. So let's hope we are. Okay, we should hear good things. And we look forward to learning with everybody. And Laila Tov. And thank you. Like I said, for those who weren't here, I hope everybody had a wonderful Pesach, an inspiring Pesach. I know you're going to say, oh, that Pesach, that was a long time ago. But okay. Anyways, be well, everybody. Thank you very much. Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.